Disclaimer. The views and opinions that you hear expressed by the participants in this show are not the views of AnimeNewsNetwork.com. The show tapes live most Thursdays, 5:30 p.m. Pacific Time on YouTube. Check out my Twitter feed, ANNZAC, for more. Enjoy the show! Welcome to NCAST. Sorry, getting a little bit of a late start here. We had some technical difficulties just now, but we're here. And that's good, because we have a very important thing to discuss today on NCAST. It's a show some of you may have heard of, a smash hit from winter 2017.
You're not wrong. It was a big deal.
A smash success from winter 2017. Called Kimono Friends. Here to discuss Kimono Friends with us is Paul Chapman. You know him from Crunchyroll News and the Greatest Movie Ever podcast, which, Paul, where can you find the Greatest Movie Ever podcast?
You can find the Greatest Movie Ever podcast and its daughter podcast, GME Anime Fun Time, at gmepodcast.com, also on iTunes.
Fantastic. And then where can people read your writing these days?
Well, as you mentioned, I write daily for the Crunchyroll news feed. In print, you can find my writing in Otaku USA magazine.
Right, Otaku USA. That's on news. That's still bimonthly, right?
Mm-hmm. Yep, every 2 months.
Okay, and also noted Kimono Friends fan. I reached out to. I was like, you know what? I should watch Kimono Friends. I should have Paul on to talk about Kimono Friends. You watched Kimono Friends as it aired, right? Or no?
After
the fact. Yeah. So, Paul.
Yes?
The duty falls to you. Tell us how Kimono Friends started. Tell us about the phenomenon, how it began.
Okay. Well, it's a little bit of an unusual story. My own experience with Kimono Friends, watched it while it was streaming on Crunchyroll. Not getting paid by Crunchyroll to talk about this, by the way. it was just one of the shows that was in the previous season. When it first started coming out, I watched the first episode. I thought, that's inoffensive, but it didn't really particularly hook me. And then a couple weeks later, about the time the fourth episode would have aired in Japan, I just started seeing this absolute explosion of fan art and all sorts of other stuff about Kimono Friends. So I decided to revisit it, picked it up, watched episode 2, was immediately hooked, and was waiting each week with bated breath for each subsequent episode. Right. Yeah, it's a very unusual phenomenon, for lack of a better word, because it's this little no-budget show. It was a mixed-media project. It was a smartphone game that was published by Nexon. It was a manga that was in, I think, one of the Ace magazines. Yeah, Kadokawa's monthly Shonen Ace. And the third wing in the multimedia project was the Kimono Friends anime. And I remember at the time, I was doing a couple of news things about it here and there, you know, voice actors joining, little bit of news dribbling out. But the big story was that the Nexon smartphone game shut down service 1 month before the anime actually began premiering, which was normally like a sort of like the death sign. You know, that's like that's seeing the Death Star on the end of you know, Fist of the North Star kind of thing. Just not a good sign. But it turned out to be like the little show that could, because this little no-budget production absolutely hooked people to the point where, at this point, it's the most viewed anime on Nico Nico, the Japanese website. The opening theme for the show, Welcome to Jabari Park, has gone gold in Japan. The Blu-rays are selling ridiculous amounts. There was such a demand for the merchandise that there wasn't any merchandise at first. They didn't know what to do with themselves. Stuff was on back order for weeks. And more recently, the show is actually going to be re-released, rebroadcast during like a children's anime time, I think on TV Asahi or one of the other stations. But it's actually getting like a real time slot rather than airing at like, you know, 1 a.m.
Right. The time slot you think maybe they would have originally planned for, you know, months and months ago before everything kind of changed in leading into the air date.
Yeah, I don't know, honestly, because it's a kid-friendly show, but it's definitely an otaku show in many respects.
Well, Jacob brings up an interesting point that I think we should definitely talk about before we really get started here. So, originally, this was going to be just a children's show airing at in a children's time slot.
I mean, we don't know for sure. There was no...
We don't know that 100%.
But it was going to be originally a little more less lorey and more like deliberately educational,
right?
And have more of the mobile game elements, like the mobile game elements as a thing to be educational, rather than the spoilers, I guess, like post-apocalyptic.
Well, like
backstory.
Yu-Gi-Oh, like how to buy action figure man stuff.
No,
like...
no, just there's a lot of anime like this, just where like the Cerulean and the Sandstar or whatever they're called and stuff like that.
Right, but that's the. Like, in the game, they just fight the Ceruleans over and over again. Like, it's mostly combat.
Right.
So, I don't understand how it would be more educational based on the game stuff.
No, I just... That stuff was used to... Basically, the thing that was missing was the post-apocalyptic aspect. So, I assume,
right.
like, they just... Like, they explain, like, I'm a so-and-so friend. It's sort of Dora the Explorer-like, where it's like, I'm a so-and-so friend, and this is, you know, I can leap 12 feet in the air. Did you know that? And, oh, no, it's a Cerulean. We have to fight. You know, it's a little more straightforward, maybe. But yeah, as it was in production for 500 days, apparently, like 534 days, and it's something ridiculous like that, over 500 days. And so during that time, they completed a lot of it. It was a very small amount of people working on this constantly, and during that time, they completed a lot of it. But like, you know, the circumstances of the actual mixed media project had changed so much that. At some point, they knew that they were going to get a late night time slot, and that's when the decision was made. I think 3 months before it aired, the decision was made to backfold a lot of more otaku elements into it, like the post apocalyptic stuff. So that's what happened. So that's pretty much all I know about it. So,
right.
Yeah, I read an interview with the director Tatsuki from a Japanese source, where he said that one of the reasons why the show has sort of such a deliberate melancholy undertone was because they were. Working on this production for 500 days, a group of about 10 people, not including the voice actors, and they got the news that the smartphone game was shut down about the same time everybody else did. So one of the things that he wanted to incorporate was sort of the sadness of seeing this project sort of slipping away from them after they had spent so much time upon it. And I think that might be where some of the darker elements of the show actually come from. Although it might be helpful to actually talk about what the show is about on the surface level.
We're going to get to that next. I just thought this was important setup. So, like, this is what the show was. Like, that's what the show is. So you know what it is. But now we should probably talk about the actual story, which is extremely simple.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. It's pretty straightforward.
I think.
Yeah.
Jacob, take it away.
Okay. So, in a sprawling zoo amusement park. So, conservation area, just huge, just many biomes park called Japari Park. There is a cat named Serval, and she is a friend, which is basically an animal that has become human. So they have ears and tails, and their costumes are a little bit, you know, animal-like, and they have some of the talents that their animals have. In fact, a lot of the attributes that their animals have, they're human-shaped. And she's one of many friends in the park. There's, like, hippo friend and elephant friend and ibis friend and just a lot of the more obscure animals.
Yeah,
and,
but interestingly, all animals that we saw at the Ueno Zoo, like, I'm pretty sure 100% of those animals were at the Ueno Zoo.
Yeah, well, and a lot of them, the choices of animals are kind of unusual. Like, a lot of them are rare. Like, yeah, there's a lion and there's a moose at one point. And stuff
I was
like
familiar
that,
with
also.
Every animal in the show because I've been to more than one Japanese zoo.
Right. But the Margay is a lesser known big cat and stuff like that.
Right.
Small big cat, I guess you could say. Anyway, the point is, so there's all these different animals wandering around Japari Park, and one day, into Serval's lap falls a new kind of friend that she has no idea what it is, because it just looks like it looks sort of nondescript. It's a human friend, basically. It's just a human, and so. She decides to help this girl who she names Kaban, which means bag. So she names her bag because she has a bag with her. Like that's you know
bag
animals.
John.
Yeah, animals' IQ, you know, yeah. It's reflected pretty well in the show, like the way animals think is a, sort of a limited scale. And so Bag-chan, people will probably want us to call her Kaban-chan. Kaban-chan decides that she's going to find out what she is, because she doesn't know what a human is either. So they say, like, journey across Jabari Park to find out what she is, and they solve puzzles and meet other animals and stuff like that. And, yeah, basically slowly unfolds what happened to all the other humans and what the secret of Jabari Park is, and that's pretty much it. It's very right. educational. You're constantly learning things about animals.
So. Yeah, and it moves at a very slow children's television pace, very, yes. very deliberate. All of the Japanese is fairly simple. Like, it's not too complicated.
There's a lot of Sugoi and Tanoshi. And,
yeah, this is fun. And the main character, Serval, is endlessly wide-eyed and in Sugoi. Awe at everything that she sees, and it never fails to point out somebody's good points. And like, there's a way that they write these characters, like Serval especially, where I feel like I'm just not capable of writing a character like that. Where like, you have like, she notices every last positive thing that you do and then tells you enthusiastically about it afterward. And I noticed how good you carried that thing.
Well, she's like a dog, basically. Like, she's a serval cat, but like, she's not, I think, less cat and more like a golden retriever became human.
It just feels like an inhuman level of, like, consideration
well,
and attention.
So.
Yeah, but I mean, like, to the point where it's like, man, you noticed that she did that and then complimented her for it. Mm-hmm. In this really, like, kind of extremely sincere way. I just am like, man, no one notices, like, that granular a level.
Well, it's very child-friendly. Like,
yeah,
the show does feel like a...
But it also, I think, adds to why the show was popular with otaku, is because that character type, in particular, is very popular with otaku. Like, she reminded me of other characters. Unfortunately, I can't think of any of their names right off the top of my head, but she really reminded me a lot of other sort of moe characters in other shows that... They notice everything about you that you want people to know or hope people would notice or something like that. Like, it's very, like, you know.
The other reason this works for us, even though the tone is 100% children's show, like, you could show this to a 5-year-old, it wouldn't be really any problem. The other thing is, like, there are no such things as, like, boy friends. All the friends are girls. So every animal
right.
friend is a girl.
But there's no fan service.
No, it's just they're all girls. Well, I mean... They're dressed in some, I would say, service-y outfits, but there's no actual fan service.
Yeah,
the way they're dressed is some of the costumes are like, oh, wow.
When you can tell what it's supposed to be,
but
yeah, it feels a little fan service. Like when you that collection of polygons is, I think she's supposed to have big boobs, but I can't tell.
Well, and that's normal also for Japanese children's show. Like, there are Japanese children's show that have no fan service, but they'll be
the characters have
skimpy,
big boobs or whatever.
Yeah, but the characters will be skimpy outfits. It's not considered sexual. It's
yeah,
they
right.
just don't really have a complex about that.
Yeah.
So, anyway, so yeah, that's Kimono Friends kind of.
Kind of that is kind of it.
Like every episode, like and it's hard to harp on it because it's like it's not really a children's show because of those otaku elements we mentioned, but those were back written in and because of the this is actually after the apocalypse. But everything else is like the structure of the episode, all the stuff that would have been planned way beforehand is the episode is we solve one puzzle and we meet two animals. Like, that is every episode. It's like,
we solve a
problem, and we meet two animals.
Yeah.
I think that, though, that there needs to be some amount of discussion about, okay, there's really kind of two layers to the show, in the sense that there's the straightforward narrative adventures of Kaban and Serval as they travel across Jabari Park through the various areas, meeting friends, solving problems, having a wonderful time, etc., learning about who they are and where they come from, etc., and then... One layer beneath that, the subtext is all of the backstory, all of the stuff that's done with environmental storytelling, the little pieces of information that they dribble out. And I thought that this is where, while the show, the visuals are nothing to scream about, the CG is notoriously floaty. You've got models that clip through themselves and such and so on and so forth.
The bus they drive through many episodes, the wheels don't spin on it. It is just a model of a bus that is being dragged across the screen. Like this, it was animated by 10 people.
My favorite were all of the aliasing problems that the show had. Like there's a lot of jaggies that appear on the models.
Screen tearing when they pan.
Screen tearing and like the clipping and stuff is funny, but like it does have kind of a low poly aesthetic to it that isn't intentional, but I didn't hate it. The way the characters move, like, You remember that Lion King in 3D video that was being passed around on YouTube
yeah.
with the really, really crappy CG with, like, Scar's mouth extending all,
right.
like, yeah, or his paws extending all, like, it's kind of like that, and it has a junky sort of charm to it.
Right. I mean, it's not so much that, I mean, like, yeah, I would want the animation. It's not like, oh, this is intended. Like, it's absolutely unintended. We were just working with what we had, but because it's so cheap, there's bad animation, like, say, like, I don't know, Isekai Smartphone, something this season that's bad animation that's not, like, there's nothing endearing about how bad it is, it's just cheap,
yeah, it's just standard shitty TV anime.
It's standard, cheap and generic, but this is, like, next-level cheap. It's, like, the models are, like, Miku Miku dance models, and the, I mean, it's a little more advanced than that, but not very much.
I've actually seen fans remake episodes of Kimono Friends in Miku Miku dance, and
right.
the animation quality is actually higher than the models
that they
use in the show.
I mean, so it's, like, Miku Miku, dance level models, and the backgrounds are, like, static and weird and don't interact well with the models, and there's a scene in the episode where they meet, I think, Beaver, where the car that, with the wheels don't, that... The wheels that don't turn on the bus push the bus forward into a plank, like a log, and the log dominoes other logs down, and it's just the most, like, animated.
There's a scene where a bunch of spherical ceruleans are supposed to be coming over a hill, and they animate the first cut of all of them rolling forward, but then the next cut they just... took the image of all of them rolling together and just dragged it over the hill.
Yep, dragged it down the snowy slope.
It's not like Isekai Smartphone where it's like, oh, this is just bad, cheap, and generic. This is, like, so terrible that it's kind of hard to look at, but, like, it's so bad that
it's funny. I didn't think it was hard to look at.
It's not like Goody Goody Fairies either, where we're deliberately hokey and bad as part of the aesthetic.
It was
like these people are trying their damnedest to make the show look as good as they possibly can. They're just not doing a particularly great job of it, and I think a lot of people respond to that sincerity.
Exactly. Yeah. Like, that's why it's charming, is my point. Like, it's not, like, off-putting bad. It's like, well... you tried. Like, that flat gold star that's, like, drawn really poorly with the all lowercase in Comic Sans "you tried" written on it. That's what the show is a lot of the time. And, you know,
I don't know. I mean, I get it. I don't necessarily want to condescend. I think that's condescending, and I wouldn't. That's not the
CG
attitude
animation
take towards
hard.
It.
You don't. Well, you don't think that. I don't think it's condescending. You don't think that they would have done better if they had the resources. Like,
of course.
So I'm not condescending. It's just like, well, you tried. This is what you had to work with.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. Sure.
You know.
I get what you mean. I get what you're saying. But in spite of all those animation problems, and in spite of the way the show looks, the stuff that Paul is talking about, the sort of layered in kind of post-apocalyptic mystery of, like, what happened here, is handled very well. It's dovetailed in with the rest of the story really well. They they line those crumbs up just well enough to make you care about what's going to happen. It's very evocative. There are moments in the show, and I think, Paul, I'm with you, like, episode 2 was where I kind of really started feeling what you're talking about. And it pulled me in pretty hard. I was like, oh, this is actually really interesting. Like, this is a really interesting way to thread a fun little science fiction thing in behind all of this that gives you more to think about and more to pursue. And yeah, I thought that was what the quality of the show was. I was fascinated to find out what the story was and what happened and why, you know, where they were and what was going on. Mm-hmm. In the end, it was a little confusing. I found myself a little confused at the end, I think, because some of the language is a little indirect. But it was all cleared up by the very end. Like, I got everything, of course, by the very end. But that stuff I thought was threaded really well, to the point where, like, Paul, what did you in particular really like about it? Like, what grabbed you about it?
Well, what grabbed me in the second episode was when I first noticed that Lucky Beast only speaks to Kaban. That idea hooked me. I'm like, wait, what's going on? Why is this communication robot not talking to any of the friends in Jhapari Park? And then another plot detail that really grabbed me was the fact that, wait a minute, everything I know about the show is supposed to indicate that, you know, here's this amusement park for people to come and play with all the animals and the friends, but none of the animals recognize Kaban. There's a lot of dramatic irony in the show in the sense that the audience knows things
the characters themselves do not, which is why I think it's also able to maintain the sort of relentless positivity in what is ultimately very likely a post-apocalyptic setting, because the characters are kind of largely unaware of how crummy their situation actually is, if they are in fact living, you know, the last remnants of a dead civilization left behind, you know, by a culture that may no longer exist. So, I mean, that was really what grabbed me, was the sort of speculative fiction element to it. And I found watching the show and it rewarding me with these little breadcrumbs, in addition to the cute, fluffy moe girls doing cute, fluffy moe things every week, was very, very gratifying. And I especially love the story structure. I love the manner in which things are revealed to you.
Yeah. That shit is good. I think that's the actual, like, quality of the show. Like, I think that's the thing I liked the most, was just the way stuff is revealed to you through simple dialogue. Very effective.
Well, an environmental storytelling, which in video games means putting a skull next to a toilet. But in this case, it actually means telling the story with the environments that they find themselves in.
Yeah.
For example, when they get to the lodge and there's this gigantic, rusted out constructor crane just kind of hanging there in a couple of the scenes, the characters don't even notice it. At one point when they're climbing the mountain, there are bombshells and a rusted out bomber crashed into the side of a cliff. You know, I mean, there's just like all sorts of little tiny environmental details that speak to a much larger story that you try to have to kind of patch things together and put the pieces together. And
right.
Done poorly, you end up with a show like Lost, you know, where they introduce all these mysteries that they never have any intention of actually...
Well, they had look. They wanted to solve those, but they thought the show was only going to go for a certain number of seasons. And when it ultimately went 7, then there you go.
Well, Kimono Friends is a little more jumped out to me as being in the tradition of, it's a kind of show that I don't see made in anime very often, but I see in it. It was a big thing in the late 2000s to now, as a thing in Western animation does it all the time. It is. Show for kids where there's this looming, like, weird, dark thing in the background. Adventure Time did it. Steven Universe did it. Gravity Falls did it. Gravity Falls is more overt about it. But that's because that's more of a dialogue-driven show. But Steven Universe and Adventure Time were not dialogue-driven, and it's like, oh, this is post-apocalypse, or, oh, this is post-alien invasion, and the good aliens are were actually bad, you know.
And surprise, your mom's a war criminal.
Do what?
Steven Universe, I was just... saying, like, the way that show develops, something seriously terrible has happened, but
yeah.
You only catch glimpses of it, like, when you see the map of the world and there's this giant ocean-filled crater where Russia ought to be. Mm-hmm.
Well, yeah, and it's the same thing, and Adventure Time is the same thing. Like, it's a boy and his dog, but they, for kids. You know, it's like, you know, so Kimono Friends is in that mold, and it, as a thing in that mold, I thought it was really good. I don't know. Like, I just have trouble summoning a lot of enthusiasm for it, just because it's like, yeah, this is a good version of this kind of thing that I've seen done and is for a younger audience. So I'm like, this is a really good kid show. But the thing, I guess the thing that personally I liked about it the most is just on the level of being a really big zoology and animal fan. Like, they pick weird animals give you weird factoids about them. It's not like just the standard, the lion lives in prides or whatever. It's like, there's a joke. So a lot of people were like, what? Is this a joke about her being American? Because there's a prairie dog character, and it's like, she's American, kind of. She coded American a little bit, and she kisses people. And it's like, is that a joke about Americans being too personal? And it's like, no, this is actually never a thing that they explain in the episode. They should have. I guess they just didn't bother to. But prairie dogs greet each other by kissing. Like, they don't literally make out, but they shove their noses together and, like, shove their little teeth together. And it's really cute. But that's why Prairie Dog greets everybody by kissing them on the mouth.
So, I think there's also a lot of stuff that doesn't necessarily translate unless you have a very strong knowledge of Japanese. For example, Prairie Dog speaks in a dialect that makes her sound like a second-rate samurai retainer, because prairie dogs live in communities that are hierarchical. There's, like, a lot of little details that go into the character animation based on animal behavior and actual zoology, as Jake mentioned.
Yeah, well...
That's cute and thoughtful and nice.
I thought that was cool up that stuff was really neat. I thought like maybe my animal knowledge just isn't really where it needs to be, because it's, in some cases I was wondering like why they were putting certain animals in certain situations. Like, who is it that runs the cafe on top of the hill?
That's an alpaca.
Okay.
They're mountain-dwelling animals. And
they, okay, but like, for whatever reason, I sort of expected them to pick an animal that you could more, like, based on their natural predilections, would run a cafe. That doesn't make any sense, though. What was I thinking? Alpaca. For whatever reason, it struck me as, like, a weird choice. I don't know why. Some of them struck me as kind of strange choices for, like, oh, you're having this animal do this
like
in this instance.
Ibis.
Like, why was the moose fighting a lion, right?
I don't know.
Why is it
moose
a moose?
They're big and tough, I guess. I don't know.
Are they also, like, really territorial? Mm-hmm. Like, insanely territorial?
In certain seasons.
I mean, they are, but
like
I don't, it's
season,
not like
yeah.
they would ever meet a lion. So.
Like, that's the kind of stuff I was kind of thinking about. Like,
they
wait,
are
these
really
two, like, why would they fight, though? Shouldn't they have made it, like, a... Some other, like another
I don't know,
line.
I just like their creative choices with the critters.
Totally. I'm just saying, like, some of this, like, a lot of it was great, but some of it kind of was like, wait, like, it wasn't very consistent, I guess. It was neat when it happened, but it wasn't that consistent.
Everybody loves the shoe bill, which
the shoe bill is
the shoe
really
bill is
good.
A fantastic
blew up my
animal.
Twitter.
If you've ever seen one in person, they have a very striking presence, and so the friend shoe bill, like, is really funny. It's just, she just stares. That's all she does, is just stares at people.
I saw a shoe bill at the UNO Zoo when we were there, and they are frightening big creatures, and they stare fucking right at you.
Yeah,
it's
into
crazy.
Your soul. It's
yeah,
great.
It's great. They're really cool. Really cool animals.
So, yeah, the animal aspect was the thing that spoke to me the most, but the post-apocalyptic thing, like, it's cool. It's just, I've seen it done before, and I feel like I will see it done many times in the future, so I just don't want to, like, I don't know, I don't want to freak out over it, because it's like, I've seen it. I'm you know, and if I want, like, a harsher post-apocalyptic story, then I can get that in more adult media, but this is like, I don't know. The hyper, let me put it this way, it's a really good show, and it's really cute, and it's, you know, the hyperbole from grown adults about
now, here we go.
About the darkness of it. Oh, it's secretly dark. Like, that annoyed me. I was like, okay. Oh,
I think you're just
done,
I think
guys.
You're just annoyed by that reaction.
Exactly. And that's it. And it's nothing against the show. The show is perfectly fine. But diving into the lore of it, talking about the lore of it, makes me feel a little bit like a douchebag, and that's totally on me. Makes me feel a little bit about like a douchebag, because I'm like,
secretly dark is
secretly
one of the
dark,
it's
whatever.
One of the internet's favorite things, because it combines several of the internet's favorite things into one thing. Mm-hmm. The internet's most favorite thing is, well, actually, which is blowing your mind, right? Like, you thought it was this way, but I'm here to tell you it's actually this other way.
Right.
What do you think now? That's the internet's favorite thing, right? So, like, like, most of your interactions with strangers on the internet, especially if you're in an opinion-based job like we are, that's the interaction that you have. That's what people chomp. If you give them a reason to, well, actually, you want something, oh, man, they'll take it. So a show like this, where it comes out of the gate and it looks like junk, it seems like we ignored it.
In our preview guide, everybody,
we didn't even, yeah. And the preview guide, everyone was like, whatever.
So in the viewer poll, the which thousands of people vote in, I remember the percentage. The Kimona Friends came dead last in the poll.
Yeah, it was dead last.
3% interest.
Yeah, 3% interest.
Which,
and
yeah,
thousands and thousands of people voted on that
poll. The threshold for, like, maybe we might consider covering this is 15%.
Yeah, right.
That's a maybe.
So we really, it was like, oh my god, no. So we wound up picking it up later in the season, though, obviously, because it turned into a thing.
Mm-hmm. Well, we didn't pick it up. We just...
But I'm just saying, like...
We reviewed,
like,
the whole thing.
I'm just saying, like, why this thing kind of roared to life. I think if you look at the way it's constructed and it has post, it's cute girls anime, but secret post-apocalypse storyline. Uh-huh. People went fucking crazy when you told them that Adventure Time was actually post-apocalyptic. Remember that?
Absolutely.
Like, it's the favorite thing to get
good,
to
I
go
think it's a good
to
thing.
Have this crazy hyperbolic reaction to.
I think
to.
It's a good model for... Oh, by the way, Adventure Time, pretty big in Japan as well. Or was at the time that it became.
Sure, I'm just saying, like,
so
the ingredients are there.
I'm just saying,
I think that there's something more, though, that we haven't really touched on yet in our discussion, which is the fact that for all of the secret darkness in Kimono Friends, there is essentially a positivity to it. It's
no,
a story
it's
about people finding their place within the natural world. And not being separate from nature, not being this other category by itself. And this show, when I first watched it, it tricked me, because I got roped in by the fact that Kaban is just a normal human being, didn't really understand the circumstances of how she came to be in Jabari Park, and then that huge reveal that she's in fact a human friend. She's part of the park as much as Serval or Shoebill or Moose or Lion or any of the other characters that live there. And I feel that people respond to that message, that ultimately positive theme, in addition to the ideas of sadness and post-apocalypse and not understanding your place in the world. I think that, you know, coming out the other side of the tunnel with a happy message at the end is something that people very much positively responded to.
Yeah, and I think it would be ruined if at any point, like, they addressed the darkness of their universe. The fact that that is kind of the Steven Universe is its own example of because it took an approach to that material completely different. So it's an outlier in this case. But Adventure Time, my personal opinion, and I've seen reflected in a lot of fans of the show, Adventure Time wasn't as good. Like, it took a downhill turn when they had the characters address the darkness of their universe. That was it. Kind of broke the magic of what made the show fun when it stopped being fun. There is kind of like a perfect balance with like letting that darkness linger in the background, but just leaving it there for the people who notice and not like calling attention to it or like trying to make that directly the theme, because then you're caught. So then you've trapped yourself. You're caught between a kid's show and an adult show. You can't actually explore these ideas with adult complexity because that's not the demographic of the thing that you created. But you've already taken that step out of forcing yourself to acknowledge this stuff. So you can only acknowledge it in the most basic way possible, which means you've limited yourself writing wise, and it's basically you're stuck between two different things that don't really taste good together. But maintaining the balance where it's 100% positive and like kids can watch it and get everything that they're supposed to get out of it, but you can pick up all these other details and get a bigger picture of it and allow yourself to make your own interpretations of that setting instead of having the show like tell you what to think and only be able to tell you with very limited language and tone, is ideal. So yeah, like if Kimono Friends like actually address the darkness of a post-apocalypse, it can kind of ruin it. So it's good that they didn't, you know?
I mean, it benefits from only being 12 episodes and filling most of its runtime with this children's show stuff. I mean, the stuff that we're talking about is it's on the edges and at the end. Uh-huh. It's usually in the last couple minutes of the episode that ramps up towards the end of the show. But for the most part, you're spending most of the show watching these little animal friends help each other out. Uh-huh. In positive and recognize each other's special abilities and what they're each
teamwork.
Good at, and teamwork and friendship.
Prairie
and all
dog
that
and
stuff.
My Little Pony and Care
together.
Bears, yeah.
Yeah. They build an entire fucking house together with an underground passage and everything.
It's pretty impressive.
Yeah.
It's a really big beaver, so.
Yeah. And I thought the post-apocalyptic story that they came up with was pretty interesting. Weird, like really weird, really strange, but very interesting and unique.
I mean, it's based on game mechanics, sort of, so they had to, you know, so it's a little bit odd.
Yeah, I know, but if you're divorced from that and you're just like watching it like as a show, taking it on its face, it's just kind of this bizarre.
It's just sort of weird, yeah.
What? Okay. All right. You know, it's a closed loop, like it all makes sense. They bring it all home and everything. Like, it doesn't all make sense, but within the rules of its own universe, like it sticks to it, and like it's not confusing or nonsensical. You know what I'm saying? Like,
there's sort of only two forces to really pay attention to. Like, I guess there's lore beyond that, but I remember it just being like two forces. Ceruleans destroy things and break them down, and this the Sand Star. Is that called the Sand Star? Mm-hmm. Like, hyper evolves things, humanizes them. And so you just, right. Those two things, that's pretty much all you need to know. I don't know. Straightforward.
Yeah.
So, you know.
I don't know. I don't know. It was cute.
It's a cute show. It's cute.
The thing I wanted to say that this show reminded me of in moments, and what I would like to see is the thing that unexpectedly it wound up reminding me of was Night on the Galactic Railroad, mm-hmm. in a couple of different ways. And what I really think, like, here's what I think would be awesome. A Kimono Friends movie, 2 hours, you get the whole story, animated, like, you know, in 2D, not in the 3D, with a similar tone to Night on the Galactic Railroad. Same positivity, but with that tone that Night on the Galactic Railroad strikes, and with a little bit, and you can spend more time in the quiet moments of the world that they're in, like, mm-hmm. the
those the parts of Kimono Friends that kind of elevate it beyond what it maybe set out to be are the moments where simple dialogue reveals major moments of intrigue, and then there's moments of quiet and empty in that show that I think work really well.
I think the most emotionally meaningful part of the show, if I remember, is when... So there's the only other evidence of there being humans before Kaban-chan is there's a holographic video log of a researcher who is maybe partly responsible for the whole Cerulean and Sandstar thing. Like, that part is never cleared up, but it's okay, I don't need it cleared up. They're a result of some sort of human experimentation of some kind. And anyway, there's a scientist there, and like she's talking about the history of this stuff, and they're like, you know, Sugoi, I don't understand what she's saying, but okay. But then Serval is watching the video, and there's a Serval in the video, and she starts crying. And that was the most, like, oh, okay. They're not, like, saying, like, I wonder if that was, like, me or someone that I know or whatever. Or, oh, I was always meant to have a connection with a human. They don't say anything like that to ruin the moment. It just speaks for itself. And then they never talk about it again. They never come back to that. And it's like, oh, okay, you're just supposed to infer. And it's fine, you know.
There's a little more to that moment that, like, you wouldn't know unless you were familiar with... Again, the smartphone game. One of the things that I did with that moment that was very clever is the other Serval in that is voiced by, I'm looking this up on your website right now, Ainonaka, who also did the voice of Serval in the smartphone game, but not in the anime. So it was a deliberate callback to the previous generation of Kimono Friends, if you will.
Interesting.
But there's like lots of little stuff like that that you would only know if you were also like deeply immersed in these other parts of the Mixed Media Project, which I only know in retrospect after going back and researching them after the fact.
Sure, yeah. Well, I mean, you know, everyone does that, right?
But no, Serval crying and not understanding why is an absolutely poignant moment. I've seen this show 4 times now, and it hits me every single time.
Really?
I've watched it.
4 times?
Yeah.
Well,
okay, when it was airing, once when I wrote a feature for it for Otaku USA Magazine, once when I did a podcast about it for my own podcast, and once again for this.
All right. Well, I appreciate that. I think you're right, though. I think you're kind of hitting the nail on the head here. And all of this stuff, like, I get it from your perspective. But I think, like what Paul is pointing out, like, I latched onto that stuff more. And that stuff kind of over... Like, all the criticism that you have, everything that you're saying, that I agree with all of that.
And it's not even criticism of the show. It's just criticism of the hyperbole.
Well, no, the only difference... Like the difference between us is just temperature of reaction. I'm just warmer to it than you are. I'm just warmer. That's all. You're a little colder on it for a variety of factors. And those are all valid. Those are all valid. But those... I'm just saying. Those are all totally valid. I'm just saying... What Paul is talking about, like, I latched onto that more, and it kind of overcame all that stuff for me. Like, it made it more interesting, and I was associating it with Night on the Galactic Railroad enough in my head to be like, yeah, I get this. I get what kind of genre this is playing off of, and, like, you know, what they're going for here. And they really do – there's moments of quiet in this show that I feel are a little – that are great. And it just – I don't know.
You can definitely get care of the people that made it, like, really gave a shit, which is, like –
Writing is good. It's a well-written show.
Yeah,
I think. Dialogue aside.
The dialogue's fine. For a children's show.
There's some dialogue, but –
It's not bad dialogue. It's just for a young audience.
Right.
And – it is weird. Like, I think, so we were talking about how junky the animation is and stuff like that, and it is junky, and I did occasionally find it hard to look at, but, like, it's funny to, like, it's weird that you can actually really sense a heart and an effort behind it, when it looks that junky, and there are some shows, like, I don't know, like, I'm just gonna throw this one under the bus, if you will, but, like, Token Ranbu this season, it's a UFO table show, looks great, but, like, people aren't really excited about it, they're not really talking about it or whatever, because it's kind of cold.
Well, they are in Japan, they're not talking about it. Token Ranbu just is, that's a bad example, I think.
It's not selling great in Japan either.
Oh, it's not selling in Japan either?
No, it's selling, like, better than most anime, but not even close to the numbers for the previous Token Ranbu series. It's very lukewarm, it's very meh, and compared to what you would expect for a Token Ranbu thing. Similar to the failure that they had with Cancol, which sold a bunch. Cancol sold a bunch, but not what they wanted it to. It's sort of like that. And the point being, like, Token Ranbu, amazing, really, really good, solid, fluid animation. But, like, you know, they're making an advertisement. Same thing with Tales of Zestiria was their previous thing. They're making a commercial, and it feels like a commercial, and it feels kind of
Yeah, it's a big, lavish commercial.
Yeah, and so this is like, you know, this was produced as a commercial, but couldn't really no longer be a commercial by the time that it came out. It was kind of changed to reflect that. Like, deliberately, they were like, well, let's make it post-apocalyptic because this doesn't exist anymore, which is funny. And it just feels very, like, earnest and sweet, even though it kind of looks like hot trash a lot of the time. You know what? The saving grace is the animation looks like hot trash. It doesn't look good, but the character design's pretty good. If you like Gajinka, which I do, Gajinka is human versions of non-human things. If you like Gajinka as a principal, like, there are really creative designs in this. The animal people look good. Like, it's like, oh, that's a clever way to interpret, like, that pattern to make it like this kind of costume or whatever. Like, so yeah, the character designs I thought were really good. It's just the animation's bad. So
yeah, the character designs are by Mine Yoshizaki, the Sergeant Frog artist.
Oh yeah.
Well, they're really good. So even I would like to see them rendered in actual, like, really good animation. Like, that would be fun. And yeah, if you like Gajinka, it's good Gajinka. It's, like, thoughtful and diverse. Everybody looks different.
I also think that the background art, while it doesn't always match with the action of the characters, generally looks pretty good. And I think the music is pretty strong for the show, all things considered, especially when, like, the Black Cerulean's on the rampage and they decide to drop the bass.
Yeah, the music's all right. I didn't love it.
I don't remember it strongly.
Yeah, I don't really remember. I mean, well, I saw it pretty recently, but I didn't, like, react that strongly to it. I noticed that they avoided having... I mean, I guess they could have just repeated animation, but they only animated those penguin girls dancing, like, once.
That, you know, 10 people, man.
Animated.
10 people, 500
yeah.
days.
Yeah. Well, what are you going
to
do?
Oh, but we have to talk about the penguins, though.
What about...
Peppa Pooh.
Great. I mean, look, there's like 50,000 clickbait articles
about the penguins.
I know,
but we have to at least mention that this is the first known example of an animal otaku.
Is it?
Oh, you mean the real penguins.
Yeah, Grapecoon. So Grapecoon, everybody knows the story. Just Google Grapecoon Kimono Friends, you'll find it. But, like, this is, I believe, the first example. So Grapecoon is a 20-year-old penguin, which is pretty old in penguin years. Like, he's got a couple years left in him, but he's not going to make it to, like, 30. He's 25 at most or whatever. And but he's an old penguin, and he moved to the which zoo is it now? It's not Ueno. It's some other zoo.
Tobu Zoo.
The Tobu Zoo, and he moved there with a mate, and the mate left him for a younger penguin at some point. So he was a single
male penguin.
Yeah, Midori-chan
dumped his ass.
Wandering around his exhibit, very lonely. And when they put there was a Kimono Friends promotion at the zoo, and they put cardboard standees of other of these Gajinka animals in each pen, and you know. Failing eyesight being what it is, Grapecoon thought perhaps that the cardboard penguin girl was a real penguin, and he fell in love with it. And he was always by its side. He made, like, little mating overtures to it. He liked to guard it and bring his food to it and eat near it and stuff like that. Like, he fell in love with Hulalu, which is the Humboldt penguin character. And they just decided, well, we have to leave it in here because he's in love with it. So even when the promotion ended and then they took out all the Kimono Friends stuff, they left that penguin in there. So this is, to our knowledge, the first example of an animal otaku who, like, you know, 3D girl's giving up on me. I'm going to fall in love with a 2D woman.
He's also pretty old.
He's old, yeah. So
I have to say, I breathed a sigh of relief when I heard that they were going to leave the Hulu standee with the promotion ended.
Don't traumatize this poor guy. Just leave him his mate.
Let him live out his years in happiness with his wife.
It'll be covered in penguin shit. But
say that again, Paul.
I said, let him live out his remaining years in happiness with his waifu.
Yeah, right, exactly. Yeah, of course. Why would you do it any other way? Before we get to Twitter questions and chat questions here, Paul, I wanted to know, I wanted to sort of ask everybody, Jacob included, of course, what do you want out of a post-apocalyptic story now? Are you over it, like, as a genre? Are you just sick of it? Because it is done over and over and over and over and over again. I really responded to this one. I thought, like, oh, this is the kind of post-apocalypse kind of a thing I want to see. Quiet, thoughtful, about the aftermath, about something that happens afterward. Not any kind of a survivalist at all. Not a fantasy about surviving an apocalypse. I don't want those stories anymore. Like, I'm bored with them. Kimono Friends just got me thinking about that. And Jacob, what's your take on that?
Well, I think I like to hold to the philosophy that I think any kind of story can be done well.
Of course.
Well, not necessarily, of course. I mean, there's people who don't believe that, and there are people who are just like, I can't cotton to this kind of story. It's just not for me. And, you know, I understand that. So I guess post-apocalyptic stuff, like, I feel like even I am inclined to say that I am not remotely interested in a post-apocalypse that is a vehicle for action or survivalism. In basically, if you can watch it and go, well, if I was in the this post-apocalypse, I would survive with this rifle and this number of rations. If it's that kind of story and you can easily do that and the show kind of wants you to do that, then I'm not interested and bored by it. But, like, I don't want to be essentialist about that because I feel like that kind of story, yeah, that kind of story might be able to be done well, but for me, I'm totally over that. I'm not interested in a survivalist fantasy. I would want a post-apocalypse thing to specifically address the question of what do you do at the end of the world? Are you busy? Wait, anyway, I'm kidding.
Have I got the show for you?
No, not that one, actually. But like, I want specifically whatever it is to address what you do when the world is over. I want it to, like, take a stance in some way, and Kimono Friends does that. The stance is, you know, you make friends. You make friends with the people who can use their strength to lift up your weaknesses. Like, that's Kimono Friends' stance. So, like, I want a show that, even if it's nihilistic, even if it's a negative answer, I want something that addresses that idea, and not, like, the answer shouldn't be an awesome badass. I was like a nebbish nobody until the world ended, and then now I'm murdering badass, and this is my true fate. If that's your answer, then jog on. Like, I don't give a shit. But like, if not, like, I want post-apocalyptic media to address that question in some way, I guess.
That's interesting. Paul, what's your take?
Well, as you've already sort of tread, there is a strain, especially recently in post-apocalyptic fiction, to be sort of a libertarian power fantasy wet dream.
Right.
And I have nothing for that. I was talking to my friend Timon the other day, and I seem to recall him and some other people mentioning that a lot of post-apocalyptic fiction is actually the real life lived experiences of people that aren't living in countries that have running water and electricity and, you know, they're torn by warfare and sectarian violence and stuff like that. So it's difficult for me, having made that realization, to want to project myself into a fantasy, a safe fantasy, if you will, when this is actually other people's real life, what they're dealing with, real lived experience. But I guess what I want from post-apocalyptic stories is sort of a sense of perhaps sadness of what may have once been, but not necessarily any moralistic judgment or conclusion on that part. Like, for example, if I was going to compare the sort of post-apocalyptic setting of Kimono Friends to anything else, what comes to mind immediately is the 70s science fiction movie Silent Running. I'm not sure if you're familiar with Bruce Dern.
Yeah.
And the forests have been taken off of Earth and put in orbit, and eventually are the caretakers of the remaining forests of what used to be on Earth are told that they have to abandon their charge. And the end of the movie is very sort of melancholy because all of the human caretakers are dead. The forests are drifting off into space with only the robots to take care of them. And there is no ultimate conclusion. There is no what comes after that. And so maybe that's what I would look for in sort of a post-apocalyptic setting.
I bet you're going to remake Silent Running.
Oh, God. It's going to be an action movie starring Tom Cruise.
God. You know what? That's depressing. Even thinking about that is depressing. Have you ever seen that movie?
No.
It's really good. It's old, but really good.
those two things are not mutually exclusive, so...
Yeah. Yeah.
There's a new upcoming post-apocalyptic anime based on a manga that looks like it might be pretty good. Oh, God, I can't remember the name of it. It was just announced recently. It's about two girls and their, like, tractor trailer going around years after the collapse of civilization, just sort of poking around through the desolated cities, finding food and living together happily as friends.
I feel like I should. Which is a good idea for a show.
I can't, for the life of me, think of what it's called, though.
Yeah.
Do you know what season it's supposed to air in? Or
I think it's coming in October. Okay. But I could be wrong about that.
I'm sure. Well, I feel like we're going to probably start seeing more stuff like that, especially in the wake of this thing being such a huge success. So, you know, that's fine. Maybe there'll be good ones. Hopefully there'll be good ones. Hey, let's go ahead and get to some Twitter questions, because we got a few of them.
Okay.
Sure thing.
While you do that, let me see if I can find it before you...
Divine Nega wants to know... Oh, this is an unrelated question. Thoughts on the Saint Seiya remake for Netflix having a writing staff composed entirely of Westerners? Maybe it'll be good.
I think the bigger strike against it is it's directed by the same person who did Cross Anjay.
Yeah, well, I mean, the guy who directed that show didn't write it, right?
No, a lot of the writing staff for Cross Ange was coming off of Gundam Seed and Gundam Seed Destiny, I think. So, you got me.
Yeah,
but I believe that's where the writing team was from.
Gundam Seed Destiny, you say? Anyway.
That sold real great in Japan.
I don't want to be like, it's gonna suck because they don't have Japanese writers. I don't want to be like that, because that's a shitty way to be, I think.
I found the name.
No, there shouldn't be any essentialism there.
They said that about Castlevania.
I've never had
Castlevania was great.
Seiya, so, yeah.
The show you were talking, the post-apocalyptic show you were talking about, is called Two Car.
Oh no, is it?
I think so. I think it's called Two Car. It's that seems like it what it was, but you know. Whatever. Two Car is the name of a show that has that similar premise in fall, so.
Let's see here. My chat stopped updating. So
No, that's a different one.
Oh, okay. Well.
Yeah, that's the Silverlink one. Sorry.
Yeah.
Sorry,
I missed the last, like, 15 minutes.
Zach, did you say that Castlevania was great?
I did.
Oh, we're going to have words.
I wrote a glowing review, Paul. It's on ANN. You can read it.
Oh, my God.
I loved Castlevania. Did you hate it?
There was nothing to it. It was a pilot movie sliced into four episodes.
Yeah, wait, that's your objection?
Anything.
That's your objection? That it's like a pilot? Because, yeah, it is. It's supposed to be. It's a movie script.
There was literally nothing there. There's no Castlevania there.
Yeah, it's in the next. They're going to go to Dracula's castle next.
Look, if you can skip the entire prologue to get to the real story, then why does the prologue exist?
That was all character building.
Yeah, it was all important character stuff and setting up and all that other stuff.
Trevor Belmont is a drunk who gets kicked in the balls a lot. Great character building.
That's an important thing to set up.
Yeah.
It actually is. It is. Yeah.
Well, maybe we'll have a Castlevania episode and you can come on and be the
fight.
You can be the wet blanket. You can be the wet blanket.
I can be to you what Tom was to me and My Kimono Friends podcast.
Oh,
Mr. Wet
okay.
Blanket.
All right.
Mr. Sandbag. Yeah, Tom, I see you in the chat.
All right. Okay. Angel X03 has an important question. Do you think the warm fan reception Kimono Friends has gotten is similar to what Ryuubi has gotten, with both being scrappy 3D CG productions?
I would compare it more to My Little Pony.
Yeah, so it's much more of a My Little Pony. Like, Paul, you're a brony, right? You got, like, you registered with the government and got the naturalization papers and everything, like...
I'm not a brony. I'm actually a little behind on My Little Pony. I haven't finished watching the sixth season yet. I've been more watching Adventure Time and other stuff.
But you enjoyed My Little Pony as well.
I'm sorry?
You enjoyed My Little Pony as well.
Yeah, I kind of fallen off of it recently. I haven't been keeping up with it like I should. Neil, who's also in the chat, is probably going to be mad because he's been meaning to podcast with me about it for a while now. But yeah.
Wait.
I'm behind.
So wait. Okay. I get what you're saying, and I totally believe you. But if you're six seasons into the show and you're doing podcasts on it, I think the brony label is like at least sort of kind of...
Hey, look, now I don't think that's fair because the brony label...
I reject that label.
Which is valid. And like I know a lot of My Little Pony fans, My Little Pony fans, who do not want to be associated with the term brony, and they reject it. And they're like, look, I love the show, but I'm not a brony, which I totally get it. It's like saying I love anime, but I'm not...
But I'm not an otaku.
An otaku. It's not really the same thing. There's a similar connotation, I think.
I'm just teasing you, Paul. I was like, wait a minute, six seasons in. But no, I totally get why you wouldn't want to. If I was really into the show, I mean, I watched a fair amount of it too. I watched two seasons and then I stopped.
Ryuubi had like a built-in fan audience
Ryuubi
to begin with.
Ryuubi was based off of the
short thing that that he did, right?
Yeah.
Though he did
and,
like a
and
short.
And beyond that, just Rooster Teeth and Money Oom.
Yeah, R&D. I can't really comment because I've never watched it. I know Victoria is really big on it, but it's
well, Rooster Teeth promoted the hell out of it, and exactly. like they, you know, they made it a thing.
It basically, it's not something like My Little Pony or Kimono Friends, where it kind of came out of nothing and came out of its own aesthetic. It came from
also not a children's
promotion.
Show.
Like Ruby is more similar to Dream Daddy, which is it had a very well known. Like it might have gotten noticed on its own, but we'll never know because it got noticed immediately because it was. Backed by like the strongest nerd voices in the nerd community.
Yeah,
it was produced by them, so that's
yeah. So
it wasn't an organic thing.
Kimono Friends was much more of a My Little Pony, like
exactly.
oh, this show for
Unexpected.
Children. Well, actually, like
exactly.
that, it was that thing,
and based on cute girls a lot too.
Sure, cute girls,
lots of cute girls.
There's no fan service though.
No, but there's no fan service in My Little Pony.
It's super
Moe. They'll find a way. You know, you don't need the fan service to be explicit.
I know. Golden Geek wants to know, do you think Kimono Friends would do well on a kids channel in the U.S. despite being originally aimed at otaku? Well, it was originally aimed at Japanese children, so maybe. The animation is really crude even by American crudeness standards.
Have you
like,
seen Bobby's Zoom?
There's some fucking crude CG on American like children's cartoons. So maybe not. Maybe it would just be fine. I honestly, like, this is the kind of thing where it, when I would, like, if I had kids, I would show them this because I think it's actually like for smart kids, like thoughtful kids, like kids who like kind of darker stuff or like themes like that. Like if you have a nerd kid, they would probably fucking love Kimono Friends.
Yeah, and really,
and it probably make
too.
Them feel like they're discovering it.
Yeah, it really young too. Like usually when we say kids can watch anime, we mean like 10, 11, 9. You could sit a 5-year-old down in front of this. I would be comfortable with it.
Yeah.
But however, I don't think so. American audience, I don't think so. I don't have an objection to this. I don't have a problem with it, but. A lot of American parents, I think, would not be crazy about the Moe girls, about every character is a girl and some of their own revealing outfits. I don't think you could pull that off.
Well, you'd have to change the outfits.
Exactly. So
you get some digital bikinis on the Kimono Friends
right.
girls.
Well, none of them have cleavage. They just have very short skirts.
There's some cleavage, a little bit.
Oh, there is?
Like, the hippo girl has cleavage,
doesn't she? Right, hippo. Well, I mean, hippo and elephant.
She's also wearing a wetsuit, though, I mean.
Yeah.
Yeah, hippo and elephant, you know, just, They it wrote itself. They were like, well, they're gonna have huge tits because they're hippo and elephant.
Okay,
it wrote itself.
Lawrence Green, do you think it's difficult to untangle genuine love for the show and ironic appreciation? No,
I don't think there's any.
I don't
ironic
think the, there is no ironic appreciation. There might have been at the very beginning. Mm-hmm. At the very beginning, there might have been like, this is good, lol. But then they're like, oh wait, no, it's good. No, lol, it's good.
Yeah, I don't see that.
Delete the LOL. Just, it's good.
I'm not of the mindset that believes in the idea of ironically liking
right.
something. If you like something, you like something.
Right.
Paul, I don't know. I disagree.
Paul
with
is
that.
Against the idea of.
Well, no, I mean, like.
Jacob and I are both strong subscribers to the idea that ironic enjoyment is a form of enjoyment just as valid as others.
There is a little show this season called Vatican Miracle Examiner that I would not defend on basically any merit, artistic, writing, pacing. Like, it's bad, but I'm really, really glad that I forced myself to watch it. So I don't.
But that doesn't strike me as ironic in any sense. Ironic seems to me to indicate a level of insincerity. And I mean, if you genuinely like something, even if it is bad, and there are plenty of things that are legitimately bad that I absolutely adore.
If
my favorite live action movie is Tank Girl. So, I think the kind of ironic appreciation thing goes hand in hand with a lot of nerd culture and kind of grew out of. You know, Mystery Science Theater 3000 and Riff Tracks and stuff like that, but
well, no, what it is a fear of sincerity. That's what it is. It's a fear of sincerity.
No,
but I'm just saying, like, I love, truly love a lot of bad movies, but I love them because they're funny because they're bad. And if you want to call that ironic appreciation, fine. Actually, I don't fucking care what you call it. I'm not gonna enjoy it the way I want to enjoy it, mm-hmm. no matter what. If I want to laugh at it and I love it because I want to laugh at it. That's fine with me.
Well, but the thing that you said, like, that's not fair when people say, like, oh, you're just afraid of sincerity. Like, that's true for some people. There are some people who
That's true for some people. I don't mean it for everybody, but there is a lot of that in it. And, like, I mean, culturally. Mm-hmm. Culturally, we were afraid of sincerity for a long time, and it's just now kind of coming back
in. And, you know, it sucks, because I don't like...
It's Gen X, a lot of Gen X.
I have an active dislike of... a lot of it came from the 90s. But, like, I have an active dislike of, like, pretending to be over everything and being emotionally insincere and deflective about stuff. Like, I don't find that entertaining. And that is an aesthetic, and some people are really into it, and I don't find that entertaining. But, like, for me, it's, like, ironic enjoyment isn't detachment. It's I'm really attached to how, like, it's camp. It's like, absurdity. It's, what the hell? How did this go wrong? How did this happen? But, like, my litmus test Paul was like, well, I don't know how you pick how you decide the line, and that's a good question. It's something, you know, it's difficult to mull over. But my personal litmus test of, do you enjoy this ironically, is, could you go up to the creator and tell them what you love about it without them being insulted? Like, every creator is different, but let's assume that the creator meant to make this, like, you know, they're not going to be like the person who was in Troll 2 or in the room and understands that it's bad. They're not going to be that. Like, say that they really, really cared about it and they wanted to make a good thing. Could you tell them why you enjoy it or start describing your love for it and not insult them?
I can do that. Like, just you threw that out there. It's a really good. That's great, by the way. I love that. Because it's really smart, and also, like, all of my favorite really bad movies, mm-hmm. I can do that, like, right off the top of my head. Mm-hmm. Like, what do I love about Congo? Mm-hmm. The performances, mm-hmm. The dialogue is great. Mm-hmm. It moves along at a
lasers.
Really fast. The gorillas look fucking amazing the whole way through. Like, right. It's really exciting and funny the entire way through. Like, mm-hmm. Ernie Hudson's great. Like, I could sit here and tell you how much I love Congo, start to finish.
Right.
I
don't think the director would be crazy about, or maybe, I mean, by now the director would be probably fine.
I think by, it, but, I think, but if you 96. Say like, look, man, it may be not exactly as you intended, but I think you made a minor, like, camp masterpiece here, and I think that's something to be proud of. Like,
oh, absolutely.
You know, like,
but would they? So this is the problem with this litmus test is it's assuming that the director might have a sense of humor about it, and if they do, then all bets are off. But pretend this director doesn't have a sense of humor about it. Like, I don't think the writer of Vatican Miracle Examiner would appreciate me saying like this is crazy triple baby Hitler hot trash. I don't think that they would appreciate that. But
if you said like this is so crazy, he probably would be like, yeah, it sure is, and laugh.
You would hope so. But like that's why it's not really a perfect test. But assuming that they meant it to be taken as sincerely as possible, would they be insulted? But it's
fucking perfect. Personally like inspired by Congo? No.
Right. Or thought it was like
it
a
wasn't
really
like
gripping,
a make-a-wish situation.
Or thought it was like a gripping action movie or whatever. Like, you know, that you wouldn't say that.
No.
So it you don't.
So you're right
it,
in that it still
you don't
might be
enjoy
insulted.
It yeah. as intended. And no. Assuming that the creator would want you to only enjoy it as intended.
Yeah.
You?
Okay.
So
right.
It's
sure.
It's really difficult to pin.
The thing is, like most filmmakers, like on that level and stuff, like you read interviews and stuff. There aren't a lot of successful filmmakers that only want you to interpret or enjoy something one very specific way, mm-hmm. their way. Mm-hmm. Like that's not like most interviews. They're like, well, what did you think? Mm-hmm. Well, I love that people love it this way. Like, mm-hmm. like fucking Tommy Wiseau.
Well, I was about to say. So here's the thing.
I mean, he retroactively tried to tell everyone that movie's a comedy, which of course
well,
it is.
A lot of that. So here's the reason I said the reason I said fresh and the reason I said pretend you're talking to the director of Congo, not now, but in 1996 or whatever, is because,
yeah, then you couldn't. Yeah.
Is because time changes those opinions. Tommy Wiseau was livid initially about the way that people treated his movie. He was furious. He went took DMCA takedowns against anybody who was like talking badly about the movie and used any footage whatsoever. He would go after them directly and pretend that he was his own lawyer. He gave himself an alternate name and it was just him. And like, you know, there's stuff about this in the biography that was written by his co-actor Mark,
the disaster artist.
Yes. And, but, like, he was livid. He was not, so pretend that you're talking to him about The Room, like, shortly after it was made, then yeah, like, that litmus test holds up. Now, of course not. But, like, so pretending that the time window is really short, like, director, usually they want you to take it the same
right.
way.
You're absolutely right.
But with time, sometimes they soften up, you know, so.
In a lot of the, I would say with time, in my experience, with time, most soften up.
Which is good.
Yeah.
Because you got
the ones that don't, like, you hear stories about what it's like to work with them. You know, let's see here. Stefan wants to know, how would you feel if a traditionally animated sequel was made which had a more polished appearance? So, like, I don't think that the quality of Kimono Friends is really in the Junko animation. Yeah. Like, I don't think it is. That's a part of it where I was like, okay, I get it. But I don't think that that's what made it good. I don't think that that's, like, an essential part of its charm. I don't think that it's necessary. Like, you have to have... that's so much a part of it that any Kimono Friends thing that's well animated would be bad. Like, that's not how I feel. What do you think?
Yeah, like, I... like I said, the shitty animation is enjoyable in its own right, but it is not an essential part of what made that show charming. So, yeah, I would be totally down with seeing it done, like, decent, making it look decent, yeah.
Right.
But it did just happen to look so bad that it was charming on its own as well. So,
yeah, I mean, I think that anime is, of course, a visual medium, but I've seen so many examples of things that had lacking visuals that more than made up for it in other areas. So I think the show could only be improved by having better visuals, but I don't think it's necessarily a requirement for me to enjoy it. If it maintains the same qualities that I was attracted to on the first, second, third, and fourth viewings, then I'm fine whether they decide to spiff it up or whether it looks just as busted and janky when we finally get that second season.
My favorite is when they hold something in their hands and there's like, you know, there's like a specific attach point in the middle.
Yeah,
of the
it's
palm.
In the middle of the palm.
they like fold their finger over it, but nothing is touching the object except for one like little pixel area on the palm.
Yeah,
it's the best.
You can't really replicate it with your hand. You have to.
Yeah. Yeah.
I know exactly what you're talking about.
I mean, they do that like the Appleseed movies. The guns are all fixed to the center of their palm, mm-hmm. and their hands basically just doing this, and they can't. Yeah, it's really.
It's another good example. I enjoy all of those movies, but they are not good movies.
Yeah. The chat brought up
Shinji Aramaki.
Well, hey, he's trying. The chat brought up The Lost Village as a ironic comedy right. type of thing, but of course, the debate over that one was whether or not it was an intentional comedy, which
I do not, for the life of me, believe for an instant that that was intended to be a comedy.
Me neither.
I think it's just Tsutomu Mizushima is great at comedy. He loves horror, but he's terrible at it.
Yeah. I think he absolutely intended for you to laugh at parts of it, but he also intended it for it to be scary. He intended both.
If you were sitting next to him and said, like, this is the dumbest fucking thing I've ever seen.
Yeah.
That was intentional, right? You were trying to make the dumbest fucking thing I've ever seen. He wouldn't be happy with you.
Yeah, I think he's not going to.
No, Another is not supposed to be a comedy. Blood Sea is not supposed to be a comedy. I don't think The Lost Village is supposed to be a comedy.
So his aesthetic, what he's trying to do is Sam Raimi, basically. Like, he's trying to shock you so much that you laugh, and the reason
he's not doing a very good job.
But the reason that comedy horror works is because you are basically grabbing onto the two most emotionally volatile responses that you can have to a piece of art, which is comedy, which is laughter and fear, and you're trying to combine those and create something new, which is very difficult. So he's trying to do something that is very difficult, and I don't think he's a failure at it because he's not boring. The worst examples of those are boring. So he's not boring. He just can't get one or the other, you know, going right. It's a mashup where you will have no choice but to laugh. You're not ever frightened, really. You just what, you know. I think he wants to scare you. It just doesn't quite pan out.
Yeah, the same Raimi comparison is a good one. But I think
he's
that really
just not good at it.
And yeah. Sam Raimi can't get it right sometimes too. Like, it's not like he has a flawless track history of this either. So, you know.
Does anyone in the chat have any questions before we wrap up our Kimono Friends series discussion? Shortest series discussion yet. Thanks, Paul.
You know,
I appreciate it.
I can keep talking if you want me to. Well, there's also a stage play that we haven't talked about, and another stage play after that.
Yeah. Do the stage plays add extra dimensions to the Kimono Friends experience?
They do. A really famous screenwriter actually did the first one. It's kind of funny. The only stuff I ended up seeing online, though, was like the animated GIFs of how they did the Lucky Beasts, where they have the Kurokuro in black, entirely black, and they like, wheel him out on a stick.
Oh, really?
Yeah. But sold out all of its performances, and they're doing another one with actually a new and an original story. I mean, that's a thing.
Oh, so this is only barely related to a previous question, but because it came up in the chat, I think not talking about this, but something else. You know who's really good at combining horror and comedy? The guy who writes Danganronpa.
Oh, shit.
Really good combination of, like, this is genuinely fucked up and terrifying, and I am upset, and, like, hilarious, irreverent, awful humor. Really good. He gets the Raimi-esque thing, and he's done it basically flawlessly. There's almost no point in Danganronpa where I'm like, it works really well.
The chat brought up a question that I feel like we can answer this one last, and we can wrap up with this one. I meant to get to it. I think we got one of these on Twitter, but I skipped over it or didn't see it again. Best friend. Your favorite
The best friend.
Animal friend in the show. Paul, let's start with you.
This changes depending on when you ask me, but I'd have to go after the technical difficulties of today. I'm going to go with Beaver because I was getting anxious there for a while.
If it were like a rainy Wednesday afternoon in September, which one would be your favorite?
Rainy Wednesday afternoon in September probably would be Shoebill.
Dang, that's a good answer. That's a good answer.
Somebody to stare at you
it's
really
like
hard.
Thematically appropriate. Mm-hmm. That's a good answer.
Well, I've spent too much time experiencing and thinking about this show.
You've spent a total it's like what 3.5 hours to get through the whole thing, or so. So you've spent like 12 or 15 hours watching Kimono Friends at this point.
Something like that.
Something
yeah.
like that. Jacob,
it's
about 6 hours a pop. So
it's 6 hours a piece.
I've spent an entire day of my life.
Yeah,
watching
an entire
Kimono
day.
Friends.
I always get 12 episodes, 20 minutes an episode.
Welcome to your Sojapari Park.
Every 4 episodes is an hour. Mm-hmm. About, if you skip the opening and ending.
I don't skip the opening and
no,
ending.
No, it's 3.
You would miss Deep Lawyer if you skipped the opening and ending in this one,
3,
Zach.
An hour. Yeah. Okay.
2020.
I lose track. Anyway.
The best, so it's hard to pick. Like, it just kind of depends. It just kind of depends on how you feel, I think. But, like, my heart says Ibis because I feel really bad for her. Like, I remember, like, I don't, like, react audibly or visually to something very often, but every time Ibis tried to sing, I was like, oh, oh, poor baby. Like, I was visibly upset by how much she wanted to sing and how much she just shouldn't ever attempt to sing. But, and also her voice actress has a really cute voice. Like, it depends, like, what you find cute is really subjective, but her specific type of moe voice I thought was pretty cute. So, but, like, it just depends. I don't know. But I'm just going to say Ibis for now, because I understand you, Ibis. You have to sing, but you shouldn't. I understand.
Mine was Lion. I thought they did an excellent job capturing the look on a lion's face and the way that a lion, like the male head of a lion pride carries himself, which is, yeah, I'm the king or whatever, but, you know, I don't really give a shit at all. I'm just going to lay around all day. That's all I want to do. And, like, yeah, I'll get up and be scary or whatever, but fuck this. Like, that's, and like, they really captured that. And the character was cute and everything, so. But I really like Serval as a character. I like that character a lot. Serval was pleasant, and I liked her every time she was on screen. It was pretty good. So
the owls are also really good.
I like the owls too. Yes. Yeah, the owls were really good.
The curry grubbing grifters.
Yeah, I like
a lot of love for Tsuchinoko in the chat.
A lot of people like Tsuchinoko. Look, I'm over the tsundere thing. Personally, I'm like, yeah, you like the tsundere, but that's just me. You
know. Which one was that?
Tsuchinoko was a snake. It's a flat
snake.
Oh,
the snake, right?
It's not a real snake.
It's not a real cryptid.
Right. Okay. Anyway, now you have the answer to the most important question we possibly could have gotten during this entire thing. And as such, that wraps us up. Mm-hmm. Paul, it was a pleasure having you on the program. You can come back anytime. Thank you very much for coming on and discussing Kimono Friends with us.
Mm-hmm. Well, thanks for having me. I haven't been on here since the last discussion with Watamote, if I remember correctly.
Jeez, years ago at this point. Years
it's par for the course with how I do things. Right. Let's do this podcast 2 years later. Oh, yeah, we're going to do that, aren't we?
Nice. All right, man. Well, that about wraps us up. Thanks to the chat for stopping by. The theme song is Bucharest. It's by the band The New Division. You can check them out at newdivisionmusic.com. Don't forget, subscribe to us on iTunes, Google Play Music, Stitcher Radio. Right here on YouTube, click that like and subscribe button. thank you very much, and we'll see you all.